طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian voice, the Palestinian narrative, from a perspective we do not get from the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that we present it each week on This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts. We begin with comments from Phil Weiss, writing in Mondo Weiss, concerning Joe Biden's recent statements, which give us an indication of what we can expect concerning his leadership on the Palestine-Israel issue if he is elected president. Quote, Joe Biden is signaling his differences with Barack Obama on Israel. He won't allow any daylight between Israel and the United States, won't air dirty laundry in public, won't even lower military aid to Israel, says a surrogate. And the American left is equally wrong to Donald Trump on Israeli issues, because it doesn't fault Palestinians for not recognizing the right and reality of the Jewish state. These comments came in a conference call from Biden's foreign policy advisor, Tony Blinken, a former deputy secretary of state with the Israel lobby group Democratic Majority for Israel. The group has ties to the right-wing organization AIPAC, which is famous for its effort to assure there is never any daylight between the United States and Israeli governments. Here are some of Blinken's comments on airing dirty laundry. Joe Biden believes strongly in keeping your differences to the greatest extent possible between friends, behind doors, having it out as necessary, but maintaining as little daylight as possible in public. You don't want to put people in a corner when it comes to your friends and partners in public. You're much more effective when you have a difference of opinion, when you disagree on a policy matter in dealing with it in private, doing it clearly, forcefully, effectively, but not airing to the greatest extent possible any dirty laundry in public. Biden is against annexation because it will set back the two-state solution and endanger Israel's future as a Jewish state, Blinken says. But Biden won't lower the nearly $4 billion we give to Israel if it goes forward with annexation. He is resolutely opposed to conditions on aid. He would not tie military assistance to Israel to any political decision it makes. Period. Full stop, he said. He's committed to it. Blinken never directly criticized Israel in the call, never mentioned occupation, settlements, or human rights violations against Palestinians, though he repeatedly criticized Palestinians for alleged incitement and not recognizing Israel as a Jewish state. Biden loves Netanyahu and looks forward to working with him to sustain and deepen the military and intelligence cooperation between the countries, Blinken assured. He is known, respected, and liked across the body politic in Israel. Unquote. Apparently, we can expect Joe Biden to be Trump too on Palestinian rights. And neither of our candidates for the Senate are any better, Joe Kennedy or Ed Markey. We have our work cut out for us. On that depressing note, let's move on to our feature presentation, which today is Palestinian attorney Diana Boutu speaking at Harvard University a few weeks ago, where Her presentation was recorded for broadcast by This Week in Palestine. Diana Bhutu is a Palestinian-Canadian lawyer and a former spokesperson for the PLO in negotiations between Israel and Palestine organizations. She has since been associated with Stanford University and Harvard University and the Institute for Middle East Understanding. She currently lives in Ramallah. Here is Diana Bhutu speaking at Harvard Law School.
What's interesting with this topic of Trump and the one-state solution is that I think it was exactly 5 years ago this weekend, if I'm not mistaken, or 2 weekends ago,
beginning of March,
that we had a conference at Harvard on the one-state solution. It was in March of 2012. Okay. And at the time, it brought together a number of different scholars and activists working on the issue of Palestine and working on the one-state solution, brought them together in Harvard, and it was an absolutely wonderful conference. And so here I am 5 years later. And we should be saying, well, you failed. But actually, feel from what I'm going to talk about today is that this is the era, this is what we are slowly moving into in terms of the one-state solution. So February 15th, there was a meeting between the Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu and your brand new fresh president, President Trump. I'm not going to say anything about him. And during the meeting, at the end of the meeting, or at the beginning of the meeting, Trump says, I quote, he says, I'm looking at two-state and one-state, and I like the one that both parties like. I can live with either one. If Israel and the Palestinians are happy, I'm happy. And so for a lot of people, a lot of commentators who heard this, they were very quick to dismiss President Trump's statement. This is a rookie president, and as one person said to me, he treats everybody like he's treating the person who puts up his drywall. He seems to be just kind of, you know, whatever works, it works for me. And so a lot of people were quite dismissive and said, absolutely, this is insane. You can't veer off of the two-state track, and that what he's going to do is send us into down to a very, very bad path. And instead, he should be focusing on bringing the parties back, bringing them back to a negotiations process. And so this is definitely not a defense of President Trump in it. No way do I want anybody to interpret this as being a defense of President Trump. But what I do want to say is that I think that the opening up of this space was and is very important. Now, I want to say at the beginning, the version of one state that Trump may be envisioning and the one that Netanyahu might be conceiving of is not the vision of a one state that I want to be part of. It's the vision of the one state that I am part of, which is the vision of one state that most Israelis are talking about is a one state in which Israel is dominant and the Palestinians are, in quotes, allowed to remain in the country. So provided that they can demonstrate some measure of loyalty, provided that they simply stay quiet, provided that they do not resist in any way, provided that they simply internalize that they have been defeated, then the theory goes and they should be allowed to live in one state. That being said, their rights are marginal and conditional upon how good citizens they are towards the Israelis and towards the idea of a Jewish state. So that's not what I'm talking about. But sadly, this is where we are going. So when we talk about one state, I want to be clear that what I'm talking about in terms of one-state solution. I don't like the word solution because it implies that we're a problem. What I'm talking about in terms of one state is a state in which there's equality for all, in which we've broken down the system of privilege that exists in the country and instead are working towards an idea of equality of individuals and of citizenship. That's not what's in play. So why is it that we are moving towards this one state, the one state that already exists? There's a number of different factors, and I'm going to try to go through all like three segments of them. The first is reality on the ground. The second is the very weak international community. And the third is the Palestinian Authority. So I'm going to begin by focusing on the facts on the ground. What I think a lot of people tend to dismiss in terms of the facts on the ground is that the number of settlements that have increased over the period of time since Oslo began is practically, is practically threefold. The number of settlements is practically doubled since Oslo began. And today, looking at the West Bank, we're now talking about some 600,000 plus settlements, on the ground. And that number is increasing daily. Just since the beginning of the year, there have been various reports, but somewhere between the number of 3,000 and 6,000 new housing units that have been announced since the beginning of the year, and construction actively in place on over an additional 800 units. Now, this is one of the largest pushes for settlements since Oslo began, and in particular since this short period of time. So it's as though the Israelis have used the coming in of the Trump administration to press the green light and move fast ahead to continue to build and expand settlements. At the same time, the number of houses that the Israelis are demolishing, Palestinian houses that the Israelis are demolishing, is reaching a crisis point, where we see that the number of homes, that the Israeli authorities demolished in 2016 far surpassed the years that had preceded it, with in some cases double the years prior. So we've got this combination of an increase in the number of settlers that are living in the country, living in the West Bank, an increase in the number of settlements that are going up, increase in the number of home demolitions against Palestinians that are happening. And what all of this is indicating is that this is not, by the way, coming out of a vacuum. This isn't just, you know, some sort of machinery that is moving along. One of the big and fundamental issues that people tend to ignore when we're moving towards this issue of one state is the power of the pro-settlement political parties that are in Israel's landscape. So since the late 80s, there has not been a single Israeli government that has managed to stay in power for the entire duration of its electoral period. And the reason is that in Israel, coalitions need to be formed in order to maintain a government. And what the pro-settlement right wing has learned is that the way that you can get more power is by forming smaller political parties, which the larger political parties have to align with, have to create a coalition with, in order to be able to remain in office. So it's not at all surprising that you see that alongside the rise of these pro-settlement political parties, that you're seeing a rise in the amount of settlements that are being constructed. But I don't want to place the blame just on these pro-settlement political parties, because they're just simply doing what people do in politics, which is they advocate and push for what it is that they want, as abhorrent as these settlement parties are. It also goes back not just to these settlement parties themselves, but to the bigger parties as well. So, for example, Likud has not ever endorsed any real idea of a Palestinian state. They've been shifty on it. They've talked about all of the various limitations that they would have to any sort of two-state solution. But it's always been quite shifty, and in their shiftiness, they've allowed these pro-settlement political parties to be able to exploit. And so this is why we are now beginning to see, this is why we're now living in the reality in which there are far more settlements, and the settlement groups have a lot, they have a disproportionate support and disproportionate weight within the government. This is why, for those of you, I don't know who's been paying attention, but you saw most recently with the demolition of Amona, the Israeli outpost of Amona in the West Bank. This was an outpost that was built on private Palestinian land. And for anybody who knows about the legal system inside Israel, the only place that you cannot build a settlement is on privately registered Palestinian land. So the landowners, alongside with an Israeli NGO called the Ashdin, came together, filed a lawsuit, and 20 years later, they managed to secure the evacuation of the illegal settlement outpost of Amman. In response, these pro-settlement groups that I've been talking about began to put forth legislation, it's been in the works for quite some time, to actually go against the Amona situation. So the legislation that they've put into place and that just got passed in February 6th and now in effect since February 13th is a law that actually, they call it the regularization bill, should be called the land theft bill. And what it does is it actually retroactively gives retroactive legal status to any settlement outpost that is built on private Palestinian land. So as I was saying, the Israelis have crafted this wonderful, very intricate system when it comes to settlements and what settlements are considered legal and illegal. And the one thing that you cannot do in Israel is you cannot build on private Palestinian land. And here comes the regularization bill, the land theft bill, that is designed to actually do that. It's designed to retroactively give legal legitimacy to any settlement that is built on private Palestinian land. Now, why is this so important? It's important because it highlights the very issue that I was speaking of a little bit earlier, which is not just the power of the pro-settlement groups within Knesset, but that on their own, the pro-settlement groups within Knesset would never have been able to pass this law. But it's the marriage of the pro-settlement groups inside the Knesset, alongside these other bigger parties inside Israel, that have allowed and that have made it such that this bill, this land theft law, is now a law that is going to be in place. And you know, it may be something that will be overturned in the Supreme Court. We'll wait and see. That's not the point. The point of the matter is that these are the forces that are in play inside Israel today. We've got forces in play that are pushing for more and more settlements. We've got forces in play that are pushing for more and more home demolitions. Forces in play that are pushing for Palestinians to be stripped of their right. Forces in play that are pushing for more land confiscation. And forces in play that are pushing for all of these settlements to be viewed retroactively. And now there's also a push in play to push for the annexation of the West Bank minus those Palestinian towns. So we are pushing towards a scenario of the one state that I was talking about, the state that I don't want to see in, but it's the state that I live in, which is moving it gradually towards that. And you can contrast this with apartheid in South Africa. And I want to contrast it, not make the similarity, I want to contrast it with apartheid in South Africa. There's been a lot of people who've made the connections between apartheid in Israel and apartheid in South Africa, and there are a number of similarities. The one big difference, though, is that in apartheid South Africa, when there was a push and this view that establishing independent homelands, the Bantustans, when that was pushed and when that was an idea, the idea was to make their lives so good in the homelands or in the Bantustans so that they wouldn't be pushing for equal rights. And you should contrast that with the way that life is for Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza, where they're making life so bad within these little independent areas that they claim to be wanting to have as a two-state solution. So in other words, Israel is not making it any better or any more attractive to push towards this idea of having a Palestinian state. In fact, it's the opposite. They've made it particularly clear that you will never have your own independent state. You will never be able to live your life freely. And instead, you will be relegated to living as second-class citizens, whether it's under equal statehood or it's under equal citizenship. Not equal citizenship. So it's whether it's under two states or under one state. So that's where the Israeli landscape is, politically. We can talk in question Q&A about where they are in terms of the social fabric. I'm not going to get into that, but I'm sure you have your own thoughts, and I'm happy to fill in when it comes to questions. How about on the international community side? The problem on the international community side is just about the same. So there's been a decision that's been in place now for several decades, since at least the early 90s, to push for the two-state solution. And you hear that. I mean, I can practically say these things blindly now. Like, I can almost read out those statements that the international community now is. I can do it verbatim practically now. They support two states. They support a negotiated process. They support whatever the two sides support. It has to be on the basis of international law or international legitimacy, and so on and so forth. And this has been the international community's position now for more than since the 90s. We're approaching close to 30 years. The problem is that there are no teeth to this statement of what it is that they actually believe in. And so any talk of veering off of the two-state option is akin to heresy, particularly in the minds of the Europeans. And being that it is akin to heresy, the only thing that they continue to speak of is the two-state solution, but at the same time, ignoring the reality on the ground. So, for example, and I'll just give you a very quick example. So, for example, there isn't a single country in the world, including this country, that recognizes the legitimacy of Israel's rule over East Jerusalem. Not a single country, including this one, as much as people may think that it's the other way around. And yet, as lawyers, the one thing that Palestinians are often forced to do is, because the system is so weak, we're forced to use the very court and the very system that the international community does not recognize as legitimate. So, for example, for a Palestinian who's trying to block their home from being demolished, as lawyers, we were always told, oh, go to the Israeli Supreme Court, go to the Israeli High Court, go to this, go to that, you know, use the Israeli system. And yet this is the very system that they've said that they do not recognize its legitimacy over when it comes to Palestinians. So here's where the lack of teeth come in. When there are pushes for things such as to hold Israel accountable, whether it's in the form of BDS, boycott, divestment, sanctions, or whether it's in the other form of incentives, all that we've seen that has happened when it comes from the international community is that we see the incentives come in place, but no disincentives. So Israel gets cajoled a lot to do the right thing, but when they don't do anything, oh, so what? And when we end up pushing for boycotts or for divestment or for sanctions, again, nothing is happening. So you see that the combination of the two, of the weakness of the international community and this fast-forward effect of building and expanding settlements, has meant that the international community is now completely out of touch with reality on the ground. They are a good 20 years behind with what is happening on the ground. So instead, they continue to issue the same statements, but there are no teeth or no effect given to this idea of what they actually believe as being two states. And this has had an impact on Israel itself. You know, settlements can be uprooted. I'm the first to say it was done in Sinai, it was done in Gaza. Settlements can be uprooted. They're just physical structures. They can be demolished. It's not a big deal. But what can't be demolished, and what's happened now as we're approaching 50 years of military occupation, is there's a mindset that has now been entrenched inside Israel that this land is Israel's, and that Palestinians are simply interlopers. That's the part that we have to get towards changing. Now, the third factor that is pushing towards one state is that of the PA. So the PA was initially conceived of as being a body that would be in place for just a short period of time It was supposed to be a transitional government that was going to govern the affairs of Palestinians. And it's not at all surprising that where you see the powers of the PA were simply confined to people. Because if you think of what Israel wants, is that it wants the land, it doesn't want the people. And they wanted to have somebody who'd be able to govern over the people. So if you look jurisdictionally at where it is that the Palestinian Authority operates, they're in control, if you can even call it that, of a mere 18% of the West Bank. So, you know, 18% of the 22%, so a tiny little spot. And if you add in the other areas that they have some form of, like, civil control, meaning that they control the textbooks and the schools and the hospitals, etc., it adds up to 40% of the West Bank. Right, so 40% of the 22%. But population-wise, the population is actually 98% of Palestinians of the West Bank. So you see that they've effectively, through Oslo, this mechanism of getting rid of the burden of having to rule over Palestinians, but while being able to take as much land, has actually worked. So Israel's still in control of 60% of the West Bank, and on that 60%, there's really only 2% of the Palestinians. The Palestinian Authority, on the other hand, 40% of the land, 98% of the people on that land. Now, that model was supposed to just be for a short period, supposed to be for a five-year period. And after the five-year period, we were supposed to be living in freedom, waving our little flags, etc., having our own airport, and so on. So we're well past that. Oslo was signed in 1993, so here we are in 2017. I'll let you do the math because I'm not very good at it. MBA and all. math is not my strong suit. So here we are, you know, some 24 years later, and we're further away from liberation than we were 24 years ago. And the problem now is that the legitimacy that the Palestinian Authority had in the 90s is not the legitimacy that they have today. And I don't just mean to imply the characters. I'll talk about the characters in just a second. But of the structure of the Palestinian Authority itself. Remember, the idea was that it was supposed to be just for a five-year period, a temporary period, until it could be demonstrated that there was a mechanism to transition power, to transition land, as abhorrent as that is. I actually think that it's a flawed model. But the idea was just, we're going to have to go through some temporary pain to get long-term gain. That idea is no longer acceptable in Palestine. And the temporary pain that I'm talking about is that the Palestinian Authority was required to, in effect, be Israel's security subcontractor. And people, at the beginning of Oslo, Palestinians at the beginning of Oslo, there were a lot of people who, there was a lot of discontent. But by and large, people accepted that model because they actually believed that the short-term period was going to lead to long-term gain. So short-term pain was going to lead to long-term gain. What's happened since is the exact opposite. People no longer believe that this structure is actually going to lead to liberation. And to the contrary, they see it now precisely as being the security subcontractor to Israel. So instead of the Palestinian Authority being in place to lead towards liberation, the Palestinian Authority is now viewed as being the mechanism that is taking us away from liberation. And you see this in the number of polls that, and a variety of different polls that have come out, with polls coming out. I think it's either 62 or 63. It's a 1-point difference. Let's go on the 62 side just so that I'm not entirely inaccurate. 62% of Palestinians saying not just that they don't support Mahmoud Abbas, the current president, but that they believe he should resign. So this is not a poll that's saying, I don't support him, like the way that you get the presidential polls in the United States and primary polls in Canada, which they have support for the president or support for the prime minister, etc. These are 62% of people saying that he should resign. That's a very high number. And in addition to the numbers of the percentage of people saying that he should resign, support for the Palestinian Authority itself, and remember, this is the single largest employer of all Palestinians in the West Bank, is in the low 30s. So the single largest employer gets low 30s support. The man who heads the single largest employer, 62% of people are saying that he should resign. That whole structure has led to people questioning whether the two-state model is the model that they believe in. And in fact, polls are beginning to show that the support for one state among Palestinians, and these are the people who are supposed to be the beneficiaries of a state, beneficiaries of independence, support for it is on the decline, and support for one state is on the rise. With some polls, usually around 20 to 30%. Oh, you'll say 20 to 30%, it's not very high. This is 20 to 30% without there being a single political party in place advocating for one state. There isn't a single political party inside Israel. There isn't a single political party among Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Not a single political party is pushing and advocating for one state. And yet you see these increased numbers of people saying that they support one state. So what can account for it? It's all of the above. The process of negotiations that I started at the beginning by saying some of the pundits were saying, this man is insane, he's crazy, we have to go back to negotiations. The process of negotiations gets even lower support among Palestinians, where Palestinians are saying, we cannot continue to go down that path. I was part of the negotiations process many, many, many moons ago. And I can tell you, having been involved in those negotiations, that there's nothing, zero, nothing, that can be done to change the structural flaws that were in place during that negotiations process. Nothing. The negotiations were flawed before we even got into the room. The idea that a very weak party living under military rule is to negotiate their freedom with their occupier is completely flawed. And we tried it. And Palestinians tried it. They tried to the best of their ability. The structural flaws cannot work. So what will work, given that this is where I see things that are going? I think that where we are going to end up is we will end up with this one state that the Israeli right wing, the pro-settlement movement, is advocating. It's a one state that is an apartheid, which is where we are. We're just a few shades away from having it be to a point where you can say, all right, there's one law that's over this land and governing two different peoples. It's already there in some shapes, but in other ways it's just a little shy of being exactly that. This is where we are going to end up. And increasingly, we're going to see people who are struggling for full equality. Already, we're beginning to see these rifts inside, or this movement inside Israel, among Palestinians who are citizens of Israel, such as me, who are pushing for much more equality within the state. There is not full equality even among Israeli citizens, and we can talk about that if you're interested. But this is where the trend is moving. So while on the one hand we are going to see the further to the right, the pushing into place of this full-blown apartheid system, unless there's something done to stop it, and I just don't see that the international community is capable of stopping it, and I don't think inside Israel they're capable of stopping it either. While we're pushing towards that, the reverse is going to be that more and more individuals are going to continue to push for equality within the state. Where that will lead us, I don't know, I hope I'm not back in 5 years to explain. I hope I'm back in 5 years with some better news. So I'm going to stop there and open it up for questions.
Thank you, Diana. Gave us a lot to think about and gave a good laying the ground of what's happening there, the international community, and what people are thinking in terms of Palestinians individually and also collectively. I think what we will do is we will, do you want to take one question at a time?
Yeah, maybe a few at a time.
We'll take a few at a time. What I would request is if you have been to any of our events, you know the rules, that you introduce yourself before you ask your question and try and keep it concise with a question mark at the end. We have about 45 minutes.
Oh, perfect. Oh, okay.
So
that was 15.
We have plenty of time.
Okay.
I will, we'll start over there and then we'll move in the back. Okay, so we have three men. Next, we'll have three women. So prepare yourself. Go ahead.
Hi, yes. My name is Nadeem, and thank you for your talk. I think you laid out a pretty compelling argument for why the window for a two-state solution has pretty much closed, if there ever was one. My question, I would like to hear more about how you envision a one-state solution. And not only that, but how do you secure the investment of Israelis in a one-state solution? You know, I mean, having the Jewish character of Israel seems to be very important to them and sort of a red line. So how exactly would it be a binational state? What type of protection, safeguards for minorities would you need in place? And how would you deal with the right of return of Palestinians?
It's like 10 questions. Thank you.
10 in one.
In the
there
back.
We go. Yes.
Yes.
My name is Ogden, and I would like to hear the political situation within the West Bank, where it would be as if it were like the state of Massachusetts or California, as a state with states' rights within the federal system,
right,
where everyone, Palestinian or Israeli, have equal rights to voting and representation in the Knesset.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Third question. Okay. Yes.
My name is Philip Lynch. I'm a local resident. Great talk and really brought some new ideas. First of all, there is a group that's in favor of a one-state solution, and that's Hamas. But aside from that, I think the one-state solution you're proposing sounds good, and I think it will probably put the Palestinians in the position of African Americans in this country after, say, around the time of the end of Jim Crow. But progress has been made there, and I think it would be probably made more quickly in Israel, since the world has come a long way since the late 19th century. And I wonder what you think about that, and if you think, I think you will be back here in 5 years, and you may be talking about that. So that's just my observation. It may be, surprisingly enough, the best solution for the Palestinians.
So it's a question.
And, yeah. Yep. Go. Okay. Great. All right. So they kind of fit nicely together. So first, I want to maybe I'll work backwards. So on Hamas, actually, it's interesting that you mentioned that they're in the process of amending their charter to actually believe in the two-state solution. Yeah. So you'll be hearing a little bit more about that in the days and weeks to come. By the way, that's not new. That was from as far back as Sheikh Ahmed Yassin when he was still alive, back in 2003, just before he was assassinated, 2 months before he was assassinated. I think it was in the New York Times that he gave an interview to them and said that he would be willing to accept the two-state solution in exchange for a long-term, like, truce, as he would call it. So that's not at all new. So actually, Hamas has kind of shifted towards the two-state rather than towards the one-state. Okay, so then I think the two questions were a little bit overlapping, which is, what kind of one state is it going to be? It's a great question. There's a lot of people working on it. There's a lot of different activists working on what type of one state is it going to be. Is it going to be a binational state? Is it going to be one state? And so there are a number of different proposals that are in place. One of the things that I think all of them agree with in terms of the various proposals, so the reason that there are different ideas is that, you know, do you want the Israelis to be involved in Palestinian education system? Do Palestinians really want to get involved in the Israeli education system? I mean, there's a lot of things like that or the legal system. Which legal system do you use? There's a lot of debates around it. That being said, the issue that you were talking about of the Jewish state, the problem with the way that Jewish state is entrenched in the country is that it's not at all clear what Jewish state means. So does it, and when I ask people, because I'm always asking Israelis, what do you mean by Jewish state? I get, generally, there's one main answer that I get, which is Jewish majority. Then the second answer that I get is the right to be able to discriminate against non-Jews. They don't say it like that. So the Jewish majority, you know, the people who live in the country know. I hate to break it to you. It's almost done. There isn't going to be a Jewish majority much longer. In fact, there's a lot of questioning whether there even still is a Jewish majority. And I'm not really sure if the Jewish majority issue is the way that the path that you want to continue to go down. Because at what point are you going to stop and say, or what lengths are you going to go to preserve a Jewish majority? Like, where does the line draw? And I'm not going to give you any of the scenarios, but how far do you take it when you see that that the Jewish majority is not going to happen? But the other idea, is the one that I say, of the right to discriminate against people who aren't Jewish, is the system that is in place now. And that is very much entrenched in not only in the political system. You have to, in order to be a member of Knesset, you have to say that you support this. Not exactly in that formulation, but political parties that have advocated one state in the past have been barred because it goes against the idea of a Jewish state. And it's entrenched in a number of different laws, with the Supreme Court itself saying that if we have to go towards this, if we have to balance out the issue of democracy versus Jewish state, we're going to weigh the Jewish state part even heavier. That's the part that needs to be broken down. And this is where you have a lot of different legal challenges that are in place in the country trying to get at that question of how far is the state willing to go to be able to preserve this ability to discriminate against others. And they so far haven't been successful. There's some little cracks that happen here and there, but by and large, it's almost airtight. For example, the citizenship law that was passed in 2003, the constitutional scholars with whom I spoke said, oh, for sure, and this is in 2003, said, oh, for sure, the Supreme Court's going to overrule this, for sure. And then sure enough, they have upheld it. And so that's the issue that needs to be the most addressed. And this is where whether it's considered to be a binational state or going to be one state in the non-binational sense of just one state, that has to be broken down either way. Because you cannot continue to have a democracy and preferential treatment for one group. It just doesn't work.
Okay, we can take three more questions from women now, and then we will mix it up. Here. We'll get to that side.
Hi, thank you for your talk. My name is Nikki Sullivan. I just would love to hear your thoughts on how you think the peace process will play out during the Trump administration, and what your view is on kind of what the future holds and whether you think he'll try to negotiate peace.
Thank you. Great question. Yes. Nancy.
And then Murray. I wonder if you could comment on the document presented to the UN committee by Richard Falk and Virginia Tilley, showing how Israel legally comports with the International Covenant on the Crime and Punishment
of apartheid.
Mm-hmm. You said the weakness of the international community is obvious, but Within the UN, do you know if any other countries besides the US and Israel had such a strongly negative reaction?
Probably Canada, but I'll explain in a second.
We have a third question here. We can get to you the next round, sorry.
So I wanted to ask about the Trump presidency as well, but given that has been asked, maybe if you could expand on the on BDS more generally and how you see they can play a role in negotiation and maybe giving the leverage to the Palestinians that they don't have right now.
And what's your name?
Introduce yourself.
Anna, sorry.
Anna, okay.
You.
Thanks, Anna. No, I just, it's helpful. Okay, so off really... Excellent questions. Wow. Hillary, I'm impressed with that. It's Harvard, right? Nikki, on your first question, peace process during Trump. I don't think there's going to be a peace process. What's that?
I was going to say, wow.
Yeah, that would be a wow. Look, I think that we'll see... There wasn't really one during Obama, either. 8 years of Obama. No, no. There are lots of different meetings that take place. And the different meetings are generally bilateral with the United States, but not really any like full negotiations that take place. Yeah.
What about in 2014 under Obama? There was that didn't count, was
it? It's not. It's never really been anything that you can say has been of any substance. Yeah. What do I think is going to happen? So first, there's some. Trump has come out and said that he thinks that he can quote do a deal. So it, like, as somebody who teaches negotiations, I've read his book. that's the end of my comment. He tends to view Palestine as though it's just like some, you know, like I said, like the like he's buying a building and that. All you need to do is put down the right price and then everything is going to magically work itself out, the details. That's not what's ever happened in Palestine. So the one, like, buying the building that he could have done or that he could do is he could say the green line is a red line. Anything that's east of the green line is a settlement, which it is, and should be taken out. And then, of course, then you work out the details. But he won't do that. He won't do that. And because he's not going to do that, his idea of bringing in some form of peace is that I think that he's going to continue to try to play the game that the Obama administration played for a very, very long period of time, which is to do a lot of conflict management that looks good, but nothing when it comes to anything on the ground of substance that changes the parameters. So I don't see him... Right now, there's a whole bunch of talk about settlement freeze. I don't know if you've been hearing about this. The settlement freeze talk that they're talking about, and from what I've heard has happened in the discussions, is not a settlement freeze. It's this is where you will continue to be allowed to build and expand, not a settlement freeze. With the idea being that Israel continues to be allowed to steal more Palestinian land. So that's not something that is going to change the scope of anything on the ground. You're looking right now at a Palestinian president who I think is going to be 82 in a couple of days. Whose support is not very high. Support for the process that he believes in is at an incredible low. He's probably the last person who still believes in the idea of a peace process. And after him, it's entirely not clear who's going to take control, like who's going to rule, if there's going to be anybody who even takes control. Whether it might be put into a different way to configure the PA so that salaries continue to run and ministries continue to operate, but not much more than that. But in terms of the peace process itself, I don't really see that that's going to come along, and I don't see that I don't see that Trump even has it as a vision for himself. On the Israeli side, the Israelis like to use the language of supporting two states, but without actually changing anything on the ground, as I was already mentioning. So they like to talk about the need to resume peace process, but they don't want to actually change anything on the ground. And this is why you constantly hear Netanyahu saying things like, we want a resumption of the peace process, but they want some carrots with it. So now the new carrot is that they want normalization with the rest of the Arab world before they even resume a peace process. There's always some sort of carrot that the Israelis are looking towards, but there isn't any idea that they have to stop settlements. And Netanyahu has been very clever, as have other Israeli prime ministers, have been clever at positioning this as being a domestic issue rather than being an international issue. So they always position, well, we can't stop settlements now because my coalition is under threat, even though his coalition is not under threat, despite what anybody says. His coalition is not under threat. So, and it'll always be this thing of, I can't stop now because these people are breathing down my back. So Netanyahu's in a very comfortable position. He gets to claim that he wants to see a peace process. He doesn't have to pay any price for engaging in negotiations or not engaging in negotiations. And at the same time, he gets to build and expand. So overall, I don't see that anything's going to change. One thing that I think is actually important also to keep in mind is that one of Trump's big supporters is a person who does not believe in two states, who actually believes in the one state that I'm talking about that is fearful, which is Sheldon Adelson. He's the person who's been funding Israel Hayom, largest newspaper in the country, and who has been very prominent when it comes to promoting some of these like right-wing organizations. So I just don't see that Trump is going to go and put anything on the line right now when it comes to this issue, because it's quiet. It's a manageable level of conflict at this point. All right, then there was a couple of other questions. There was one about Nancy's question on Richard Falk and Virginia Tilley, and then about BDS. So the report is excellent. It's a fantastic report. Yes, the crime of apartheid, they lay it out very nicely about how it meets exactly the definition of the crime of apartheid. The only little thing that that they didn't go far enough in is focusing on Palestinians who are citizens of Israel and how they fit into the bigger map. But that's, we'll leave that one aside. Of course, the report was quashed with Rima Khalef resigning from her post when she was forced to take it down. Are there other countries who are opposed? I think Canada may be one of the countries that's opposed, only because Canada shifted during the Harper years before Trudeau came into power. And Trudeau, I know you all love him, right? I don't. He hasn't shifted back. He hasn't shifted back, and that's why I don't love him. So Canada might be another one of those countries that that also is on that on the issue of supporting the quashing of it. The bigger issue, though, Nancy, is that the diplomats know what is happening on the ground. It's not that they're oblivious. If you see a settlement, it's not like they're like these little. It's not like it's a little yurt in the center on a hill. Right? It's a full blown city. They see what's going on. They see the construction. They see the home demolitions. They're helping to push back against some of the home demolitions by funding some of the tents that go up, etc., and relocation. So it's not that they're oblivious. It's that they feel that they're helpless. And it's the point of not taking action that is going to lead us down this path. Now, to your question on Anna's question on BDS and could support for BDS change things, it already is. The Israelis at one point had listed the two main threats to Israel, BDS and Iran. Like, I'm not sure how nuclear weapons. Boycott, but whatever. And so the level to which the Israelis are going to try to quash BDS is huge. And the reason is because it opens the door. Remember I was saying the international community is not doing anything? It opens the door to allow the international community to do something. If you look back at South Africa and the way that BDS happened in South Africa, they were engaged in a BDS process for 20 years before they got the first resolution in the UN General Assembly pushing for BDS. So the Israelis rightly know that once you open up that door, it can lead to larger international movement for sanctions, and a larger, not just international in the sense of you, me, and everybody, other individuals, but government as well. And this is why they're putting all of their energy into, or a lot of energy, not all of their energy, into quashing it. Things like they said that they were going to civilly assassinate the leader of the BDS movement, the various measures that they've taken to try to go after people who support BDS, including just recently passing the legislation regarding not allowing people to come into the country who support BDS, to creating a registry. They're talking about creating a registry of citizens who support BDS. So I think I'm on that registry, but whatever. So, you know, all of these mechanisms that they're doing, and I wouldn't be surprised that they're going to start going after individual citizens of the country who support BDS, because it's the one area where it can then lead to something even greater. Will that help the peace process? I still don't think that there's a peace process that's happening any longer. And from what I can see in Palestine, there isn't even a peace process group any longer. There's still an industry, but there's no group any longer.
You have been listening to Palestinian attorney Diana Boutu speaking at Harvard University. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. You can hear all our past broadcasts on our archive, thanks to the meticulous work of our colleague Stan Robinson. In your browser, go to truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and click on This Week in Palestine Archive. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.